Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirk the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely surrounded by my stuff. Recently, I read Paul Auster's final novel, and the narrator referred to his study room as the Cogitorium. And that's what this den is going to be from now on, a Cogitorium. I don't know what it is, but it sounds good, and the perfect place for the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files here on my right. Here on the left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, this time the Eternal Champion has appeared as Dai at the Earth's core, a menagerie of weird and wonderful creatures. This time we're looking at monsters and bestiaries. But before then, we've had another lovely five-star review of the Grognard Files on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to the Grogpod, then they're often a better guide to what we do than me explaining it. So here's the review from Magic JMS in the USA. A warm blanket. Just a delightful experience where Dirk and Blythe bring you into their homes, their pubs and their phone calls to talk about tabletop games from the 1980s and today. My only complaint, really, is that the episodes come out relatively infrequently. Once I caught up and binged the whole library, the wait for each new episode becomes interminable. Keep up the great work, fellas. Thanks. That's a good name for a band, Infrequent Blanket. We're trying to catch up and become more regular, but it's been a bit difficult to get together in the recent months, but that'll start to improve in the second part of 2024. This episode is in several parts. This first part is me and resident rules lawyer returning to a tried and tested formula of stay, play and give away. Well, we've done it once before. This time we'll be grabbing three bestiaries each from our shelves and decided which one to keep for reference, which one we want to play right away, and which one is heading for the dumper. Back in March of 2024, I went to London to visit a symposium about RPGs. You can read more about it at thegrognardfiles.com. While I was there, I met China Meville, the science fiction author of The City and the City, amongst others, including a newly launched collaboration with Keanu Reeves, The Book of Elsewhere. He's a listener of the Grogpod, and he suggested that we looked at bestiaries. And monsters are the reason I got into this thing of ours, so I've been more than willing to put this episode together. Next time, we'll develop the ideas further and have special guests, including the monster man himself, James Holloway, who will be adding to the Appendix G. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Stay, play, give away!
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
We really need to do this in a pub. It's been a while, isn't it, since we've done it in a pub? We've not been out. We've been denied because of your electoral endeavours.
My electoral endeavours, yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's been a tough old few months. The local elections, and then a few weeks later, a general election. Yeah, but then again, I'm glad it's over. As I said to my boss on the night of the count, they were counting the votes. We were coming to the end where we're about to announce the results. And I said, imagine now, if you woke up in bed and it had all been a dream and you had to do this all over again.
Just wait until we get in the pub. It'll be like the Taylor Swift effect, won't it? The GDP will bounce.
Drinks all around.
What I've noticed from people talking about the election is that particularly our generation, so Generation X, is that realisation that the change of government doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it's true that, isn't it? In our lifetime, there have not been many actual changes. You know, let's face it, there's been lots of changes of prime minister. Let's go for a couple of years. I've lost count who was prime minister when.
One of the podcasts that I like listening to, as you know, is Word in Your Ear with rock journalists David Hepworth and Mark Allen. And what they did is look at the pop and rock charts from now and going back to when there was changes in government and comparing the difference. And so like they noticed that back in 1997, the pop charts were filled with Britpop, full of bands. But now you look at the charts, there are no bands in the charts. Where are the bands gone?
There are bands, but they're not, I know what you mean, they're not in the charts, are they particularly? I don't know what's going on anymore. So I'm saying there's no bands in the charts. In all honesty, there could be, but I don't know any of them are.
Well, let's not get diverted by music. We did that last time. What I thought I'd do is look at the charts from a gaming point of view. What are they gaming? So I'm only here for the Kia. He's moved in, and this is what was in the top three of drive-through RPG when he was elected. So Keir Starmer was elected. Number three, Traveller Bounty Hunter. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, I've heard of that. It's a new thing, I think, isn't it? Yeah. It's quite good.
They bring him out quite a lot, don't they, these Traveller?
They did do a lot of stuff for Traveller. There is a lot of stuff for Traveller.
Number two, and this one's appeared before when we've done one of these, is Fabula Ultima Atlas. Fabula Ultima Atlas. Now, Fabula Ultima are based on Japanese computer RPGs. Number one, and this is topical for the Grognard Files, Cyberpunk Edge Runners, which is in a different setting than Cyberpunk Red. It's 2070, and it's based on the anime that's on Netflix. So of those three, it's kind of a dystopian view of the world, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if Fabula Ultima, is that dystopian? I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, it is. It is like a techno fantasy, which is quite dystopian and bleak and that kind of techno future.
If things are bad, do people go for dystopian stuff? Because I was once watching something, we're going back to music now, but I suppose there are parallels. It's relevant. I was once watching something about the 70s and people said, oh, the 70s were power cuts, and which I know is kind of like a bit of a myth, isn't it? This thing about the 70s being really bad. But you had glam rock and you had all this stuff going on. It was quite, people wanted to be entertained and wanted to forget about miserable stuff. You know, so the music didn't actually reflect a lot of the music, popular music, didn't necessarily reflect the difficult times people were living through. But that with gaming, a dystopian kind of thing is kind of does reflect, I would argue, some may disagree, but I would argue that's what we have been through, isn't it, recently?
And what strikes me about it is that the science fiction role-playing is very predominant at the moment. I think we're leading the trend here. I do. Let's go back to 2010. So imagine you're on the Rose Garden, a coalition, first coalition.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the Spam Face Puffin and Meta's T-Boy. Do you know what was dominating at that time? Top three. If you look at the Ennies.
Go on.
Pathfinder. And if you think in 2010, that's when we started getting back into it after the deep freeze started to thaw out. And Pathfinder was very apparent, wasn't it, at that point?
It was very apparent because I have quite a vivid memory of going to Fanboy 3 in Manchester. Before they moved to the bigger shop, they had a small shop, didn't they? Yeah. It was one of the first places we would go in there, wouldn't we? And we were a bit unsure as to whether we wanted to buy any of these new games. And I think Pathfinder that I picked up and flicked through and said to you, blimey, I can't be dealing with this. I can't be learning this. You know, I have enough games in my head. Quite funny thing now, given all the games I've bought. But That, it's quite interesting that, because that was the, and I do remember Fanboy almost being like wall to wall Pathfinder.
Yeah.
Doesn't have as much in now at all, does it? But now, then it had a lot of Pathfinder in. And I remember wondering what this Pathfinder was.
2010 and the Ennies, it won the gold winner for the game. It won it for the adventure and for the GM screen. So it was like the ultimate dominance of the thing. And I wonder what changed that. Was it the D&D 5th edition and people moved on to that?
Never played Pathfinder.
I've read some of the adventure path. I've always been attracted. We're talking about bestries in this episode. Mm. And I've always been attracted by the goblins and the way that they treat goblins in Pathfinder because of the way that they draw them. But they have a lot of variations on goblins, like monkey goblins and different aspects to their ecology that make them very interesting as a species to include in your games. And some of the adventure paths are quite inventive.
Ooh, but, I don't know why I've never played it. I'm not sure. It comes across, I think, sometimes as a bit of a club. I've always found that a little bit off-putting. I don't know. I mean, it's like role-playing can be accused of being a bit clubby, can't it? You know, how would you get into role-playing games? It can be a bit clubby. But it's like a club within a club, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, where they, and I know other games do that. I know DCC does a bit of that as well. And I think Free League have started to do similar things, but you know, not necessarily a reflection on the game. I don't know, something about it.
When I started getting back into it and listening to podcasts, there was a podcast called RPG Dad. And it was about somebody of our age getting back into role playing after a period of not playing. He brought on a number of people who explained to him the Pathfinder. I did think it sounded quite intriguing because, as you say, there's a clubbish feel to it. And as part of that, they had ambassadors who were there to pitch how the game was played. 5e has started to do the same approach where it's become multiplayer so that it, you know, you have multiple settings set in the Pathfinder world. So if you want space, there's space there for you. And 5e started going down that route, hasn't it, doing the Spelljammer and bringing
I think the game might be all right. I don't know. It's like you get like stars or something. We at Convergence, weren't we? Someone ran Pathfinder and they get like stars. Like at McDonald's where you get a star on your badge or something for running games.
Yeah.
It strikes me as a bit, I don't know. No thanks.
So that's Pathfinder 2010. Let's go back to the heady days of 1997. It's a new dawn, is it not? Tony Blair is sworn in. And at this time, obviously, we were in the deep freeze, so I don't know whether we can say very much about this, but I think the top games of that time reflect something of the 90s, because what you've got there is Multiversa. No, I don't know what that is either.
Nope.
Blue Planet, which is about playing dolphins, I think, in a strange
way.
And number one is Legend of the Five Rings.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So Legend of Five Rings, we played the Fantasy Flight version of that, which I think is very different from the one in the 90s. But I think concurrent to it was the collectible card game element to it, which is very 90s as well, isn't it?
Mm.
Let's get...
Don't know what it says. Don't know what it says about a change to the Blair's government. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe gaming is immune to the zeitgeist of what's happening and it's got its own trajectory. So in the 90s, it was about pushing new ideas and new ways of playing games and trying to push beyond some of the things that were developed. And yet, it returned back to something more traditional in the form of D&D. And now, after that, the cycle is now at a point where actually, we want a more diverse idea of games, more diverse collection of games.
I know. It's kind of an interesting question, isn't it? Because it's certainly true that games that are being produced now, that there is a number of games that definitely want to reflect changing attitude to gender and race and things like that. But prior to that, it's almost like gaming just exist almost in a vacuum to some extent, you know, doing its own thing. And maybe that's a byproduct of gaming getting a bigger audience and becoming more broadly known. Whereas go back to the 90s, the 80s or the 70s, and it's a very, as we've talked about endlessly on this podcast, it was a very, very small group, relatively speaking, a small bunch of people where if you said to your, you know, for example, I went to get my hair cut, right, the other day. This is relevant. Bear with me. Let's get my hair cut. And I had a D&D t-shirt on under my shirt. And the young guy cut my hair said, "Oh, what's on t-shirt?" And I showed him and he went, "Oh, Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah, I played that. Yeah, one of my mates played it." And that would have never happened. That would never happened 10, 15, 20 years ago, would it? It'd be incredible. But it didn't seem like that unusual. So maybe nowadays gaming does reflect what's going on in the world a bit more because it has a broader audience. Whereas the further you go back, you do look at Legend of the Five Rings and John Major's Britain shifting to Tony Blair's Brazil. How is it relevant? It doesn't really connect to it at all. But of course, back then it would still been quite a small bunch of people, wouldn't it, playing?
A smaller bunch of people than in the '80s.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe that's the thing, you know, it doesn't reflect the times, but now it does. Now it's started reflecting the times because more people want that.
So finally, let's go back to 1979. And Mrs. Thatch, Francis of Assisi? Let us bring despair where there's harmony or something like that. I can't remember.
Let us bring discord where there's harmony, something like that. I mean, that might be not what she said, but that's what she did. Bit of politics.
Yes, indeed. And I've gone back to White Dwarf 12, and in White Dwarf 12, these are the role-playing games that were being reviewed by the likes of Don Turnbull. And there's not that many, but High Fantasy is a game I've not heard of before I looked at this. It's a role-playing game in the mode of D&D, has all the D&D elements, but it's a percentile opposed role system. Never heard of it. It gives it 4. So that's why we've probably never heard of it.
But 4 out of 10.
4 out of 10.
Yeah.
And this is like the Circle is Complete. The other thing he reviewed was reviewed by Bob McWilliams. The Kinunir, the traveller first adventure.
Oh yeah,
not sure which vowels to pronounce in there.
What does that get out of 10?
That gets a 9 out of 10. It would do because it was the first adventure. But it wasn't an adventure, if you remember. When we covered it, it's very disappointing because
as a lot of the early traveller ones were. To be fair,
pitches itself as an adventure.
Yeah,
and it is actually just a series of bullet points for you to fabricate something from, so it just gives you the material for you to work from. But there you go.
But has nothing to do with the fall of the Labour government and the emergence of Thatcherism. Hard to draw any conclusions there.
Let us say that was the dawn of Thatcherism. Travellers still in the charts. Isn't there a sense of continuity? I will leave that hanging in the air.
Well, there you go. What do those games tell us about politics in Britain? Nothing at all.
D.D. Miles.
Okay, from one pointless exercise to another, let us have a go at Stay, Play, Give Away. This is a segment that we've only done once before, where we look at items off our shelf. It's a bit of spring cleaning. We're going to determine which items on our shelf we think we should keep because they might have some relevance in the future. And we want to have them to refer to, or which one have we got a burning ambition to play? It's on our shelf, but we haven't played it. And the other one, would we quite happily give away? Now, we got complaints last time, Blythe.
Did we? Complaint?
I think it's because we didn't give a full commitment to actually give anything away.
Oh, you mean we have to actually give it away?
I have difficulty giving it. I have I have difficulty clearing up. I mean, I can barely exist in this room. There's no air left in it because there's so much stuff in it.
Yeah, it's difficult to give things away. I have a number of things lined up that I keep thinking I need to put these things on eBay or get rid of them in some way. But at the same time, I look at them and think, but you never know, do you? You never know. And then occasionally I look at them and think, maybe I should run that again. Didn't quite work the first time I ran it, but maybe that's me. Maybe I should do it again. And then you think, if I got rid of them, I couldn't think that, could I? I couldn't have. That's not an option anymore, is it? Because they've gone. And we've made that mistake before, haven't we, in our youth?
Yeah, maybe
you more so than me, you know. Yeah. I got rid of some stuff. You got rid of more stuff than me, but I still kept some. But even things that I regret getting rid of. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've done it twice before, really, because, everything mysteriously vanished when I left home. My mum got rid of it. And the other part of it was when we started playing a little bit of D&D back in the early noughties with Kevin. I started to restore some of the collection then. And then when we stopped playing, after a couple of years, I got rid of it again. And then building up this, it's like a hoarding instinct.
But giveaway is difficult.
It is difficult. At the start of this year, I proposed 365-day giveaway. And I thought, I need to get rid of some of these books I have in here because I just can't move. And so I was going to give away something every day, just post it to people so that they could get the pleasure of it. Well, I soon stopped because I got rid of some books and then I listened to a podcast and thought, oh, I've got a copy of that. No, I haven't. I've given it away.
Yeah. So it's all right having these plans, but then you've got to do it, haven't you?
And you've got, yeah.
Then you realise the full horror of what you're doing, giving stuff away. We've all done that. I've done that. Yeah. The thing where you've given it away or sold it, got rid of it, and you can't quite remember getting rid of it. So you convince yourself it's somewhere. It must be somewhere. I don't think I got rid of that. I don't think I gave that away. And you like turn the house upside down. And then it finally dawns on you. Oh yeah, I think I did give it away. Yes, I agree with you. I'm not really one. It's a theoretical giveaway, isn't it? Everyone. Yes. A theoretical giveaway.
Does that take a little bit of a shine off the format? I think we should at least give some sense of commitment. But let's see how we get. So stay, play, give away. So what is going to stay on your shelf of the bestries? But before we do that, what makes a good bestry? Because we have covered bestries before. We looked at the Monster Manual. Oh, yeah. We've looked at some of the games that we play and some of the bestries. And I suppose this is an opportunity to think of why it is. What makes them special? Why do they have an enduring appeal?
Well, I think they have an enduring appeal because they often just lie at the heart of, they lie at the heart of most games, don't they? So monsters, creatures, things, beings, aliens, they do lie at the heart of most role-playing games, don't they? Unless it's a role-playing game which clearly doesn't have things like that in. So it's, Gangbusters, for example, clearly doesn't have monsters in it. Most games do have something like a bestry at the heart of them, don't they? It's a short list of role-playing games that don't have monsters, isn't it? It's a short list, isn't it?
Yeah.
Much shorter than the list of games that do have monsters. So they're quite central to most role-playing games, whether they're fantasy monsters in a traditional kind of fantasy setting, science fiction, aliens kind of things. And I must admit, I always find a game that doesn't have many monsters disappointing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for example, Morkborg, people like Morkborg. And Morkborg is interesting because it has this thing with goblins, doesn't it? Where goblins, if you get bitten by a goblin, eventually turn into a goblin. It's like a curse. That's quite good. That's quite a good little twist on a goblin, isn't it, that? But it doesn't have many monsters in the rule book. It doesn't have many monsters. It's somehow a bit, all right, but I could do... I know people say make your own up, but it's not quite the same, is it? It's nice to be presented with a fairly extensive list of monsters, isn't it? I think that's one of the keys to the game is a good kind of extensive list of monsters. That's quite crucial, I think, in any bestiary for me.
I think it conveys something about the setting as well, doesn't it? So what you encounter in the worlds that you are adventuring in says something about the place as well. When I want to understand the game, and I've said this before, it's the first place I go to, really, is the bestiary, so I can get a feel of what is it that you do here? Because very often it's the bestiary or the monsters or the creatures that you encounter that is what you do in the world. So they're the antagonist to the protagonist of play characters. So as a GM, that's the bit that you're going to have to get your head round and know how the world works, and you do it through the people who inhabit it.
And also, if you buy a game where the bestiary is it bestiary? Is it bestiary? Is that how you pronounce it? Not a bestiary.
I think it is.
Is it bestiary?
I think we used to call it a bestiary.
Bestiary. I think we used to, yeah.
And the thing is that before we had a podcast, who cared?
No one cared. No one could correct us. People were writing in right as we speak. Bestiary, that's not how you pronounce it. Perhaps you speak the King's English. Oh, sorry. Monster book. Call it that.
No, it's called Monster Book.
Monster Book. If ever you buy a game that has a supplement, an extended supplement of monsters as a separate book, I always find that's the one thing I always go for. So if you buy a game where, like with Traveller, for example, when I started buying all the Mongoose Traveller stuff, one of the first things I bought was the Aliens of Charted Space Volumes 1 and 2, which not quite a monster book, but it gives you the alien races, which are kind of important in Traveller. They're important in a sci-fi game. And there were, when I bought the core rules, I think the next one I bought might have been Volume 1 or Volume 2 of the Aliens of Charted Space, because I thought, You need to know about the Varga and the Aslan and the droid and all that. It's important, isn't it, in the game, because aliens are important in sci-fi. You do want an extensive beastry, monster book. And we might come on to this later, because it's an interesting topic, I think. You want the monsters to be interesting as well. That's a big part of it, I think. You want the monsters to be interesting monsters, rather than just a load of orc type hit things with hit dice and swords that are just essentially just a lot of people, but they've got, you know, green skin or whatever. You want things to be interesting. That's another key component.
When we look back at, when we looked at Monster Manual, and that was a long time ago now, about 8 years ago, as part of the podcast, look at D&D. And that is just like a listings book, isn't it? It's just a list of monsters. And you get really relatively little information about it.
Yeah.
And I think we made the comment before that variations on the same thing are not necessarily that interesting. So we said that we made the point, didn't we, that when it gets to the point where everything's a giant weasel or giant
weasel. Even the giant, fire giant, ice giant. Yeah. Mountain giant. They're all just giants with clubs. I mean, essentially just giants, aren't they? You know, it doesn't make them that much more interesting.
As it's presented there, and I think when we look at some of these bestiaries, that's what people have built on, isn't it? That over the time that they've realised, there's not enough just to do a listing. If you look at the fanzines back in the 1970s, 1980s, they were replicating, even White Dwarf, they were replicating the idea of listing. The way that And you could look at a troll pack and look at some of the fanzines that looked at the ecology of monsters, and White Dwarf as well started to look at monsters as more of a, how they threaded into the world and became, had a bit more to them than just a straightforward listing of what they did or their attribute.
Yeah. And I suppose, I mean, I might be wrong in this, but it feels to me that RuneQuest really was the first role-playing game to really do that, to make monsters kind of integral to the world and also make monsters not necessarily evil, they're just different. I mean, Chaos, I suppose, in RuneQuest is evil, so your Jack-O-Bears and things like that, you could argue, are are evil. But things like Moracanthan, trolls and dragon newts, they weren't evil. They were just different. They just lived differently and had a different culture. And yeah, I suppose that is quite a revolutionary thing in role playing, that RuneQuest really brought that. Maybe other games, I'm prepared to concede, maybe other games did as well. I'm sure other games did. Yeah. But mainstream kind of games. That.
But maybe it's because it was two things. It was built on two things, wasn't it? Like All the World's Monsters, which was Steve Perrin's supplement. But also The Sea Caves, which is a supplement that we've talked about in the past, that said, you know, remember, the monsters get experience rolls too. And I always think that is very telling about RuneQuest, that actually they're living in this world as much as the player characters, and they've got a life beyond when they appear on the camera lens. You know, they change and do things off screen. And it gives that indication. Also, I think Borderlands is the first time I read anything, that supplement for RuneQuest, where it talks about the tactics of the monsters when you encountered them, how they would respond to being attacked, what the general use of weapons were. Which is very familiar now.
Oh no, they sat in our chairs.
So let's have a look at what we're going to put first up for a stay. What's staying on your bookshelf?
Staying on my bookshelf, it has to stay on my bookshelf, is the Malleus Monstrorum, the Cthulhu Bestiary. Volume 1, Monsters of the Mythos. There are two out there. There's deities, but there is a monsters book. And that, it's got to stay. I can never imagine getting rid a book like this, because so what you like about Cthulhu, it is a game you go back to, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a game you go back to. You remarked on this the other week. It's a long time. We're not playing any Cthulhu at the moment, are we? And it's been a long time since that's been the case. We've always had some Cthulhu going on in the background somewhere, haven't we? And I do think it is a fantastic, the monsters in Cthulhu are great. They're just great monsters. They're weird. They're alien. They're frightening. They still frighten players. You know, it's one of the few games where people can have played it for a long time on and off, as we have. But once you start to throw some of the monsters in, people are still frightened of them because of the things they can do to you and the effect they can have on your mind. So it's a fantastic, and it's a great book because it just collects everything together, gives you all the background of everything. And again, like you say, talks about, I mean, it's probably not right to say that some of these monsters have a life beyond, they're not, that they have a life anywhere in some other dimension, but it does give you that sense that all these creatures fit in somewhere and are kind of have their own motives and are doing their own things. And it has to stay because you know you'll come back to it. I know I'll come back to Cthulhu. There's nothing surer. Look at all the games on my shelf. It's the one game I know I will be playing again at some point.
I think it's got that quality, hasn't it, the Malleus Monstrorum? Pronunciations.
Well, in picking things I can't pronounce. Yeah. Should have picked Monster Manual. Monster Manual instead. Stick to Monster Manual. Monster Manual, yeah.
It has got the other quality that's essential to bestiaries, is that you can dip into it. And if you go into there, you can start to look at some of the features of some of the encounters, and they develop scenarios. And it's a while since I've had a look at it, but does it expressly give you scenario hooks? But some of them do, don't they?
It doesn't, not as such, but it does, indirectly it does, because as you say, there's so much information in there that inevitably when you read them, ideas kind of spring forth. So it's the complete opposite of the kind of monster book that just gives you a load of stats so that players can hit things until they start moving, sort of thing. It doesn't, not like that. It gives you the stats, obviously. But it gives you their ability, the background, the history of these monsters and that kind of thing. So whilst it doesn't give direct scenario hooks, it sort of does, because there's that much information in. It's kind of inevitable that, you know, and at the back, it also has like more, it has the kind of traditional monsters as well. So it has a mummy in and things like, you know, it's really, really good book. Great book. And a book you can never really be without, I don't think. If you're going to play Cthulhu, it's the one supplement you've got to get, I think, really. Not going anywhere, that one.
My nomination for staying is Out of the Shadows, which is book four of Dragon Warriors. We talked about Dragon Warriors, I think I remember saying at the time that the whole appeal of Dragon Warriors was, in essence, the bestiary. And it's fairly simple mechanically, but what this book does is give you a short narrative about each of the monsters that exist in the world of legend. It has that legendary quality, because that is the thing that I love about monsters. I think that's the thing that I haven't lost the thrill I get from encountering monsters and reading about them. When I think of how I got into The Hobbit, it was via the monsters. And I think what it does really well in here is that sense of ontology, that these creatures exist on the edge of your imagination. And when they're explained here, it's like they've always been there as part of your own personal mythology.
You're right. That is the thing. When you go way back to us going into Boydell's Toys and seeing the Citadel miniatures, the thing that drew us in was the miniatures of monsters, wasn't it? Some of them, obviously, familiar monsters, and then other things that were a bit puzzling and a bit strange. But that was the kind of initial lure, wasn't it? That you had these miniatures of monsters and things like, you know, skeletons like Jason the Argonauts or a dragon or a troll or something like that, that kind of lured us into playing the games, really. That was the kind of spark, wasn't it, that got us into them.
I've been doing my own homebrew games of setting Racklash, which is the world I created for a postal game that we played. And as part of it, I've been creating monsters. But what I've realized is that, in essence, what I've gone back to is how they're presented here in the Dragon Warriors book. The way that they describe, they are in blocks of text. So it's unlike modern approaches, where they tend to be in bullet points or give you just a quick summary, a quick burst of the features of the monster. In this, it is something that you have to read, because it's a story about how they exist, where they're likely to be encountered, how they manifest, some of the features of them. But they're not expressed mechanically. It is done very prosaically. And as I say, I keep coming back to it. I keep looking at it, because there's a certain magic to Dragon Warriors. What's the bestiary that you want to play?
Well, the bestiary that I want to play is, again, I don't know how you pronounce it. I pronounce it Vaesen. Is it Vaesen? 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 Vaesen. Tomato, tomato. But Vaesen, the monster section in Vaesen, which is one of my favourite games. And one of the reasons it's one of my favourite games is because I think the monsters in it are great. And I suppose it's unusual in that the monsters in it are drawn from Scandinavian myths, so they're not. It's quite different from Cthulhu, in that the Cthulhu monsters are the imaginings of crazy people. I mean, they're kind of crazy monsters, aren't they? You know, but Vaesen are not pedestrian, is the wrong word, but they're kind of drawn from myth, so they're all relatively familiar. There are one or two that are unfamiliar, but I suppose if you were Scandinavian, they wouldn't be unfamiliar. They're only unfamiliar because I'm not Scandinavian. But they're all drawn from myth. But what I like about it and love about it is the fact they're all so, I suppose it's a bit like Dragon, like you've said about Dragon Warriors. What's good about it is they're all so well drawn and well presented and well thought through in terms of the motives, what these monsters want, why they're, you know, why they're aggressive towards humans, and how to defeat them in ways other than just straightforward combat. It's not quite a case of combat. It's about, you know, tricking them or, you know, doing a particular thing, getting certain materials, a ring of salt or an iron horseshoe or something like that, or luring them into a barn and that, those kind of things that they're not necessarily straight. It's not a question of just going shooting it or hitting it with a sword until it stops moving. It's not a case of that. They're very well drawn monsters, very atmospheric, because you get the feeling in the rule book that each monster has been thought about a lot by the designers, and they've thought about the monster's kind of traditional history and myth and how that monster will fit into the world. And you come back to that idea that I talked about earlier with RuneQuest. The monsters are not all necessarily bad. Sometimes the monsters are the people who've upset the monster, and your job is to kind of find some kind of negotiation between the human world and the supernatural world. That's what I kind of really enjoy about it, is that it's really well considered set of monsters.
I've played Varsen base more than I've not actually games mastered it. So it's unusual in that regard, because I have a different relationship to it perhaps than you do, because my experience of it is playing. What I find engaging about the game is that you have to have this role of mediating between the supernatural and the natural world, and trying to reconcile the differences between the two. And as you say, it's not always just a case of defeating them or overcoming them physically. It is sometimes just changing the behavior of the people that you're having to deal with.
Yeah.
I think the other element to it, and this is what Free League do really well, when I come to looking at my player game, is just the illustrations of them themselves.
It's a beautiful book with great illustration. And that's an interesting thing about Abestria as well, isn't it? That the illustrations are quite important, because often you don't know what these things look like. Even if you say it's a goblin, you go, "Oh, a goblin, what a goblin." Oh, everyone knows what a goblin looks like. Do they? Really? Everyone's got a different idea, haven't they? So even the most mundane monsters, having an illustration and having a good illustration, quite important, isn't it?
Yeah.
And as you say, in Vason, they're all illustrated very, very well, beautiful illustrations that bring them to life on the page.
Yeah, I agree with you that we need to play more Vason. Whenever it appears in a convention game, I want to play it. Ooh. And so it is a game I enjoy playing. As I say, I've never run it. But I've also never run another Free League game, which during lockdown I bought a lot of, which is Forbidden Lands, which is their post-apocalyptic fantasy world, very much based on OSR exploration, hex crawling, and rediscovering a world that has been through a certain trauma. And the Book of Beasts that was produced a couple of years ago is a beautiful book. The Forbidden Land books are kind of four leather, gold inlaid, and the way that the monsters are presented, they've got a consistency of art. They're all drawn by Henrik Rosenberg in a kind of pencil effect. You can spend hours in this book, blithe. don't buy the game, just buy this book. You'll spend hours on it. And so sometimes it's about how monsters are presented, and in this kind of standard approach to how they're done, there's like an excerpt of how people think about them in the world. So if you get something as mundane as a giant spider, it's how people feel about it in the world. It also has tables, it has some charts that you can roll against to see what the lore is. So what rumours do you as adventurers know about these creatures? So that's a Games Master's bit of knowledge. So you've got some tantalising ideas who they are. But the great thing about it, and the thing that they've adopted from Alien, the Alien game they've done, is that they have a random attack. So they have multiple ways of attacking adventurers, and you roll on a dice, and some of them are just like incredible.
I do like that. I know Alien does that, and I do like that idea that you roll on a table because it ramps up the tension of the fight kind of considerably, doesn't it? Because the players know that the Games Master can't go easy on them. That dragon that's got breath attack, you roll the wrong number, that's what you're getting, whether you like it or not. And I do like that. I like it because it takes a bit of the moral responsibility off the Games Master, doesn't it? Because there's always that moral responsibility when the players are in a fight with a monster, and you think as a game, this monster's not too tough, it's not too difficult, they'll be fine. And then the monster rolls really well, the players roll really badly, and before you know it, everyone's on just a handful of hit points, and you think, oh, this is going to be wrong. This is the opening encounter. They're all going to die. And of course, as a Games Master, you can always go easy on them, can't you?
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to use its claw again. Oh, why is it not going to use its beak that does 3d10 damage? No, it's going to use its claw that does d4. But not with that. No, you roll on the table, and I'm afraid that's what you get. But it's not my fault. To quote a man we know from Liverpool, it's the dice that killed you, not the Games Master.
I think, 50 years on from D&D, we need ways of making the familiar seem unfamiliar. And I think that's what, by giving these random attacks, it's got a bit of excitement, a bit of unpredictability. Yeah. As you say, it takes some of the moral responsibility off the Games Master. But it also makes it fun for the Games Master because you don't know.
No, you don't know what the monster's going to do, there's almost like a game within the game for the Games Master there, isn't there? Yeah.
It's quite exciting. Oh, what are they going to do? Yeah. Oh, it's going to spew out zombies, this creature. Yeah.
And I suppose what both Forbidden Lands and Basin do is a bit like you say about the lore and the rumours about a monster. Is they give a certain significance to a monster as well. They give it a certain gravitas and a bit of weight. Because one of the problems with role-playing games sometimes is, I can remember playing a game at Expo. Obviously, Duff Games at Expo, isn't it? Of 13th Age, which I didn't particularly care for. But that aside, it was like a load of monsters. It was a load of lizard men, then some frog men, then a giant slug, then this, then that. It just felt like going through the motions of just slaughtering monsters and fighting monsters. And none of these monsters really felt like they had any real meaning in the world. Whereas I think what Vason does and what Forbidden Lands does, it gives the monsters like some relevance in the world. It gives them a bit of weight and a bit of meaning.
Yeah.
Whereas in some games, you just end up, they're just things to fight. They're just things to fight. Oh, you're ambushed by some... I remember this game, we were ambushed by some frogmen.
Scuba divers.
Yeah, not scuba divers. That would be quite interesting. It wasn't as interesting as that. Time-traveling police frogmen. What are you doing here? It wasn't that at all. It was hybrid men-frog creatures with googly eyes, you know, those kind of things. But it just felt like was you're just ambushed by these creatures and you just had a big fight. Could have been ambushed by anything. It didn't really matter. Whereas I think Forbidden Lands and Vason, what they do is they just make those they give the Games Master something and the players something where those monsters are important. They're important things, unusual things, scary things, or relevant in some way. And I think that is quite crucial to any good game when it comes to monsters.
So what are you going to give away?
I think this is quite telling, this. This is almost like therapy. This goes right back to the first new game I ever bought, Numenera. And I remember being completely entranced by Numenera. And I still am. I still think it's a good game. And I think maybe the reason I'm going to give it away is perhaps more to do with me than the game. I don't know. We'll see, won't we? We'll see. On the face of it, the bestiary, the monsters in that core rule book and some of the subsequent rule books, there's a supplement. They're all weird and unusual. And there's a lavish illustration of each one. Well done. Brilliant. You know, full of imagination. But what I realized, the more I ram Numenera, the more I realized I didn't know what to do with these monsters. I didn't know what to do with them because they were all so weird or unusual. I used to sit there and think, flicking through all these monsters, thinking, you know, I was running a scenario for a convention, or I think their Wednesday Club played Numenera a little bit for a while. And I remember flicking through all these monsters thinking, red one. Oh, this one looks good. No. This one, where this one? Oh, no. How about this one? Mm. Because they're all so weird that you think, I don't know, just don't know how to use them meaningfully in a game.
When we talked about Numenera, we discussed this a little bit, didn't we? That if you've not got a frame of reference of what this, the creatures or the entities that you're encountering are, it's very difficult to visualize. And when it's difficult to visualize, you're already on a back foot as a GM.
Initially, it wasn't a problem, but the more I ran it, the more of a problem it became. Because I think when I ran it initially, you'd flick through the monsters and you'd dismiss lots of them, and then you'd find a couple and think, all right, okay, yeah, that's okay. But then eventually you thought it was like diminishing returns. You'd be looking through it more and more and more and thinking, there's less and less and less of them I can use, really. You know, I just don't know what, instead just don't know what to do with them because they're so weird. And they do weird things. And again, it's kind of odd because when you read it, you read all these weird things that they can do and think, oh, this is great. This is great. This is different from other games, isn't it? But eventually you thought, oh, I don't know. But there's one that's like a giant with this big domed head with a population living inside it. And you think, oh, that sounds really interesting. What the bloody hell am I supposed to do with that? I don't know. Is that an adventure in its head? I don't know. Sometimes I just scratch my head over these things. And in a way, I just kind of gave up on it, I think. Well, I have given up on it because we've not played it for a long time.
We can expect to give that away. My giveaway, you've already mentioned it, is 13th Age, Bestiary. 13th Age is a game that I've ended up with a lot of stuff because if you go to conventions, you end up accumulating quite a bit of Pelgrane stuff because of the offers that they have. If you have a multi-buy, so you find that your library is filled with it. And 13 Days has always captured my attention because I like the idea of it more than actually playing it. So I've played in a few games, and I've run 13th Age Glorantha a couple of times and I found it okay. But as a system, for me, it's not for me in the sense that it's quite a lot of mental arithmetic, and the numbers are really big, aren't they?
I've never understood it as a game. I dislike it quite a lot. I don't. As you know this, and this is why I probably brought it up, to goad me into saying why I dislike it. But I've never quite understood it, where one of the arguments, and I'm not saying this is necessarily an argument from the people who designed it, but one of the arguments I've heard used is you get these monsters. You get a character with it, these characters got 100 hit points, and the monster's got 100 hit points, and everyone goes, all right, great. But then people are rolling 8d8 damage or 10d12 damage. And people say, well, that's so the fight's over quicker, you see. It's to get rid of the D&D grind. And I just thought, well, why don't I just lower the hit points of everything? It's my least favourite fantasy game. I've played it a couple of times. And it's been, I suppose it's been okay. Not been terrible. But I've always thought as a system, it just seems like a bit daft. I don't see the benefit of the system. Don't see the benefit of ramping everything up so much. You know, when we played it once, you were a barbarian. I think you did 10d10 damage to something. So the fight was over relatively quick. But you just think, well, if you want to get rid of the grind of D&D, play something else or just lower everyone's hit points.
It's due to have a second edition. What I think with 13th Edge and my experience of it is that it's full, it's rampacked with really good inventive ideas, but it doesn't cohere into a satisfying whole. And I think the Bestiary is a good exemplar of that, because on the face of it, it's actually very good because it presents D&D monsters in a very inventive way. Yeah. So if you take something like a boule, land shark, which I quite enjoy, there's lots of adventure hooks that it provides to tell you how you might encounter them. They also have a number of variations of familiar monsters. So they actually give them a different appearance. So they're not as mundane. So kobold, for example, it plays around with the idea of, you know, in some manifestations, a kobold might have draconic in nature. In others, they might be dog-faced in nature. Maybe have a mixture of the two. How do those different factions deal with it? So it feels like a brainstorm of people throwing down ideas that are really incredible. But it comes back to what we were saying about the Kinyonia, the traveler supplement. It is just a load of ideas that you have to kind of scratch your head and work your way through. So it feels like a lot of effort compared with something like Forbidden Lands, where at a glance you can quickly make an assessment. Okay, yeah, as a games master, I'm going to use this in an inventive way. And also it's another quality of Dragon Warriors, because here it presents a hag, and the hags are very perfunctory and mechanical, and whereas in Dragon Warriors, they're instilled by the way that they're written about.
I think that's part of my dislike of it as a game, that it feels a bit functory. It feels a bit like that generally, that it's quite, I know all games are mechanical. I know they're all mechanical, and I know you could say D&D, you could say, like, you know, old school essentials is mechanical in that sense. But I don't know, with 13th Age, it just comes across as a bit of a cold game where it might have ideas in it, but they are presented. And when I've played it, and I've only played it twice, so, you know, I could be wrong. But when I've played it, it just felt like going through the motions of rolling lots of dice, doing lots of damage.
For people who like a lot of game in the game, I can understand how it fulfills that. I also like the sense of wonder. And I think that's what's been extracted a little bit.
I think that's, it's kind of interesting that your issue with the Bestiary, it does kind of lead into my issue with the game generally, and the way it kind of played when I've played it, that it just feels a bit like it's had all the wonder sucked out of it.
Yes.
Somewhere. And I know. I mean, I like gaming my game. And I know there are other games that are very gamey. There's some games that are very gamey that I like. I mean, DCC, which I love. It's very gamey because you're rolling on tables and stuff. But DCC's got a certain charm and a certain wonder and a certain something about it for me, which I think 13th Age just didn't. It just felt like a really cold dice game.
And I suppose that's
kind of interesting what you say about the Bestiary, that, because I've only played it. I've never actually read the Bestiary, but it's interesting that what you're saying about that does connect to my general sense of it as a player.
It's a made for TV game. Whereas there's something about Dragon Warriors and Forbidden Lands that has got a touch of the otter about it, a certain consistency of style and a sense of wonder when you encounter the monsters. And despite the number of ideas that he's got, it somehow doesn't capture the imagination the same way. So that's wonderful ideas.
And I suppose that's true as well of Numenera. That's similar to my issue in Numenera, in that has lots and lots of ideas, but somehow they don't connect in the same way. So you could argue Vaesen has far less ideas in it, in that the monsters are quite traditional monsters. So you could argue there's no surprises in there. But at the same time, like you said, there's a sense of mystery about them and a sense of it fires up your imagination more.
Yeah.
Whereas in Numenera, when I first encountered the game, it sort of fired my imagination up, but then almost burnt my imagination out because I didn't know what to do with these monsters, didn't know what to do with them. Teleporting robot teapot, whatever, that's doesn't know what it's doing anymore because it's from a previous, you know, there's this kind of stuff where you think, what do I do with that? And I suppose it's similar to 13th Age in that
yeah. It
feels so
somewhere, one of the ideas
lots of ideas, but disconnected in some way.
So one of the ideas, which is fantastic, is that there's a bullet, land shark.
Another monster car weapon, another thing we don't know how to pronounce. A bullet. We need to pick things we can pronounce. We can just stop doing this. Why are we doing this? Pathologically drawn to things that we can't pronounce.
So a land shark roading on.
Yeah.
So a scenario hook is that the locals have a land shark bullet. Mm. That they have as a rodeo. So they've got to stay on the back of it.
Yeah.
However, it's got on its underside a map of a dungeon tattooed on it. So this boule is got something else that the players crave. Mm. So when they've got this festival of the boule, they have into, you know, the rodeo and somehow get hold of the boule. Now, on the one hand, you say, what? Brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Brilliant idea.
Mm.
What I put to you, well, Blythe, you could replace that idea with a donkey.
A sacred donkey that the villagers wouldn't let you go near because it's a sacred donkey.
Exactly.
The same difference. See, you're the same dilemma.
What is the boule adding to this story?
Yeah, what is that adding to, you know, is it the danger of the boule? But, you know, You could have a bull, couldn't you? They're quite dangerous, you know, with it tattooed on its underside. It's the same difference, yeah. Yes, exactly, yeah.
So there we go. That's our stay, play, giveaway. Mm. And there's not enough donkeys in these things. Here's Blimey.
Goodbye.
I'll get me caught. And we're heading towards the door. The game is over, but we can't resist a little bit of chatterage. What is the closing time chatter, Blythe?
The closing time chatter. Well, this last week or two, I've turned my attentions back to the Pirates of Drinnak because I'm very aware that as we get into August, to the end of August, we'll be soon starting the third and final season of the Pirates of Drinnak. So I've got to that point where we finished, I think it was around April, wasn't it, this year? And so I've had a few months away from it. And I've got to that point where you get, as you do with these campaigns, where I thought, oh, hang on, I need to like kickstart this up again. I need to fire this up, fire the engines up on this, don't I? And do a little summary of what happened in the last season and start thinking about how we're going to get back into the next season. And also it's the final season as well. So again, the trajectory of it is towards the rise or fall, as the case may be, of the empire, the Drinaxian empire, isn't it? So it's something that started preoccupying my mind in a little way where I thought, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just have a think about the first few sessions. And there's a nice little adventure in the Drinaxian companion. That's quite a nice one. I thought that'd be a good little lead into the, and then started thinking, oh, hang on a minute. What happens after that? And then what happens after that? And then when we get beyond Christmas, it's going to have to kind of be coming towards its conclusion. So it's kind of filled in the last week or so. It kind of filled my head with a mild sense of panic. Because I do think, people have said to me, who've run Pirates of Dreams, oh, you've done it over three years, you know, three seasons. That's my kind of intention, because I do think these things can go on too long. I don't think you can keep running it open-ended forever, because I think it's a danger where it will burn out. The last two seasons of it, there's been a nice momentum building up, hasn't there? And it's got to a point where, even though there's lots of stuff in the Pirates of Drinnet, and the stuff we've not done, the stuff we won't do because you've chosen to go down certain roads, I think you've got to live with that and move it to a kind of conclusion. Because
I think we should push you to a fourth season. The ill-advised fourth season. Because you've been... spoiler alert, if you're playing Pirates of Drinnet, put your hands over your ears now.
Yeah, leave the room. That blew Peter, isn't it, when they made a Christmas present for your grandma. Yeah, grandmas leave the football results. Where they always say leave the room, don't they, before they give the football results. It gives you very little time to get out of the room. I've noticed these days it's a very tokenistic thing. They say, and if you're going to watch Match of the Day after the news, leave the room now. Then they're giving you the results. You've got like split second. Anyway.
So at the end of the cliffhanger last time was that we were presented the idea that this was all preordained. So it's almost like a foundation where there's...
Yeah, I must admit, when I read it, a bit of Pirates of Drinnet, and then I watched some of Foundation on the, what is it, Apple TV?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, right. Yeah, okay.
And I suppose Dune as well. Foundation and Dune have this idea that actually the conclusion of this is predestined, and you as play characters can either confound that predestiny or you can try and make sure that it's fulfilled.
Yeah.
So you're presented with that dilemma. You can eke that out for at least...
eke that out forever. Well, it might go to a fourth. We'll see. But that has definitely occupied my thoughts of late, because I've started to think, all right, you know, there's a lot going on here, and we need to sort of get on with it. Yeah. I think, I don't know, I think this, maybe four, but it does feel where we... I know what's going on. You don't, because you're a player. And at the point we're at now, and the things that are going to happen in season three, I think when you see what happens, I think you'll start to agree, oh, right, okay, now we're getting to crunch point, really, with this. That's the thing. And I don't think it would be much fun if I held off those crunch things until season four. I think it might start to sort of sag a bit, maybe. I think there's a point. There's a good cliffhanger before Christmas. It'll be a Christmas surprise for you. That's all I'll say.
I'll look forward to that.
Yeah, but that's my thoughts at the moment.
Very similar. I've been thinking about Battle Beyond the Stars, you know, the 1981 film, Roger Corman with John Boy as the...
The leader. Yeah.
Magnificent.
They would take it seriously because he was in it, John Boy.
It's the Magnificent Seven or Seven Samurai in Space. You know that it's Magnificent Seven because Robert Vaughn essentially plays the same character.
He's in Bo.
And clearly they saw that there was a lot of money in Star Wars, so this is a Star Wars ripper. And James Cameron did the effects. And a bit on the nose, some of the design of the spaceship. If you want to, I won't. I won't go into it here, but they wanted a feminine shape for the spaceship because it was controlled by an AI called Nell. And they did a feminine shape for the spaceship.
Yes. Maybe not the most appropriate feminine shape.
And I got this idea whilst I was watching it that I think I've got an idea for a sequel. And the idea that Geralt, Robert Vaughn's character, had a lot of treasure And somehow that could be the MacGuffin that the sequel is looking for. And Sedar, the big baddie, who is able to reconstruct himself so he can use body parts from different elements to make sure that he's continues. He's got like a longevity because he's able to replicate. He's got this mad doctor who's able to put the limbs from other alien species, and he becomes kind of this hybrid of different things. I got this idea that Robert Vaughn gets killed at the end of Battle Beyond the Planets. But what if Sedar tried to recover himself by replicating himself as
Robert Vaughn?
Robert's Gelt, yeah.
There you go.
So this idea. So I did a one-shot for Savage Worlds, BotCon, using it. What I'll say is I've run it once and I've got it out of my system by then.
Yeah. Yeah, as you do, as we do with these things, that's what we need to do, isn't it? You know, we're not the kind of people who run something seven times. We're not the kind of people who say, there's a convention next November. I think I might dig out the old Battle Beyond Stars Savage Worlds scenario that I've run 17 times. That is never going to happen with us, is it?
No.
Three strikes and you're out. Maximum for anything.
I went into that thinking, I'm going to play this with a straight bat. I'm going to play with a straight bat, the idea, because it's pretty risible, the whole setup of this. You know, a cowboy with a whiskey and soda belt. But I'm not going to play into that. I'm going to try and play it straight-laced as though it's Star Wars or something. Within minutes, I was taking the mickey out of the whole setup.
It's possible. I'm surprised you tried to play that straight.
I couldn't.
No, I was, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. And the players really went for that kind of artificiality of it. Yeah. You're in a cave, but the floor is incredibly flat and black.
There you go. Sci-fi is the order of the day, isn't it? You know.
Sci-fi is the order of the day, and I'm going to make an admission now. We're amongst friends.
You're amongst a friend.
Yeah, that's true. And nobody's listening to this.
No one's listening to this.
I very proudly displayed the characters that I made for Savage Worlds, Battle Beyond the Stars, and showed them on shown them on the Discord of how I'd managed to very carefully recreate the characters of the Nastar, the cowboy, Shad, the Valkyrie, and Cayman, the lizard. And, you know, people give me likes, you know, that self-validation. Forgive me, Blythe, for I have sinned. Because I created all of those using ChatGTP.
AI generated, pre-generated characters.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's amazing. If you put in an instruction that says, create me a Savage Worlds Adventure Edition character of the cowboy from Battle Beyond the Stars,
it will do it.
It will do it. If it's not quite what you want, you can say to it, okay, make sure that you've got the whiskey and soda belt. We've created Shad. Yeah. You've not recognised that he's part of one of his hindrances is that he's a pacifist and doesn't like violence. And you can refine it in that way. And I know that there's a lot of people who have a downer on ChatGTP and generative AI, but I have finally found the use of it.
It's the one use. It's, don't worry, it's not going to launch the missiles in a Skynet-style fashion and wipe out humanity. But if it does, at some point in the future, at least in the meantime, it makes generating Savage Worlds pre-gens easier. Or maybe any pre-gen easier.
Yeah. Yeah. I could have spent hours doing that, but I didn't.
Yeah. So even though humanity's time may be shorter on Earth because of AI, at least some of that time's not spent wasted tediously generating pregens for gaming conventions. So, you know, it's not all bad, is it? No, but people knock AI. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I welcome our AI overlord.
Yeah. And I got loads of likes and I passed it off as me.
Yeah, over. There you go, you see. Yeah. That's the modern world. You know, get the AI to do the work, get loads of likes, and yeah, what's wrong with that? It's not going to put anyone out of work, is it? Can't see a problem. These Luddites, what do they know?
Yeah. All I'd say, by is don't tell anybody about it.
No, I won't tell anybody.
I'm dying.
I think I wouldn't worry because I think at this, probably now, most people stop listening. We bored them with all the bestiary stuff. Or probably annoyed them because we kept saying bestiary when it's bestiary. To the point where no one's listening to this. But you'll be fine. You'll be absolutely fine. They're not listening, or they'll just zub through it to see whether they're going to get a patron's going to get a poof or whatever. Or something off a random table. I wouldn't worry. I think it'd be fine. No one will know. The secret's safe for me.
Yes, Blimey.
Cheers.
There isn't another bit.
We've got more of this, Bobbins, next time with our guest, James Holloway. If you're interested in the role of RPG monsters in gaming, you really must listen to the Monster Man podcast. It's interesting, illuminating, and useful. There's no Grog Meet in Manchester this year, as our normal weekend in November 2024 clashes with the MTV Awards in Manchester. Taylor Swift's entourage has requested to move our event so that it leaves some hotel spaces for them. Instead, it will be held face-to-face in January. See thegrognardfiles.com for details. However, I want my RPG. So we're running an event online on the 8th to the 10th of November, and Grogmeet-ish has all the fun of Grogmeet, but online instead. Thank you for listening to another round of this, Bobbins. Please pass it on if you think someone else might like it. Thanks to all of the patrons who've supported us in the past and in the present. It's really appreciated. Next time, I'll hand out some virtual monster stuff. But until then, adios, amigos.